It's April 1st, and you're in the right place at the right time. Good evening. We're blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your podcast player like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. From the city that never sleeps across the Atlantic Ocean, I am George Norrie, wishing you a good morning or good evening or whatever the case may be across these many prolific time zones. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Tonight on Coast to Coast, we'll hear from a man whose mother-in-law is an alien, although she insists she did not probe him. And did a flying saucer crash in Roswell, New Mexico? Later, does Roswell exist? After that, does New Mexico exist? After that, are new and Mexico really words at all? Following that, what are words? Are aliens words? Are aliens a hoax? Are all hoaxes a hoax, making everything that's a hoax really true? Tonight, questions to your answers. Answers to your questions on Coast to Coast AM. Also in this show, we'll hear from an expert neurobio, socio-astrologo, paleontologo, gist, who claims that an ancient alien civilization of Atlanteans built the Statue of Liberty. Answers will be answered. Questions will be questioned. Tonight, only on Coast to Coast. Happy April Fools! Now, the moment you've been waiting for, the moment your friends, your enemies, and your in-laws have been waiting for, or they haven't. We're back with season two of This Is Going Well, I Think, with David Cooper. I am David Cooper. It's This Is Going Well, I Think, a show where no one's listening. No one cares, the show where every episode's the last episode. And in case you didn't catch that stupid introduction, no, I will not be doing any UFO content. And unless you're a real Radiohead, that is, someone who loves radio, like me, you won't know what the hell I was talking about. Basically, I just spoofed a bizarro UFO overnight radio show that, well, when I was on commercial radio, I used to compete against the shows called Coast to Coast. And while it used to be about UFOs and aliens, it's gone pretty crazy down the far right conspiracy corner. So enough about Coast to Coast and more about today's show. Happy April Fools. On today's show, science expert Dan Riskin is going to tell us all about the upcoming eclipse. And our friend, the lovable Tony Five, and I are going to discuss how we first met, because the story's kind of wild. We met on a live radio program, and Tony's a little peeved off because the new James Bond is rumored to be, well, not just another British white dude. Why this bothers him, I have no idea, but we will find out. And we've got a professor who's written about sex in Canada who can definitively answer the question, do people who identify as feminists have better sex? I identify that way, and I'm pretty sure everyone who's ever had sex with me has had a bad time, but we will find out more. The professor's name, Tina Fetner. Oh, and I figured out a way to take phone calls on this show, so later on I'm going to take a few on my favorite topic. Yes, I'm trolling you for April Fools. That topic is going to be pet peeves. So you got all that and more to look forward to. But first, this. It's news, 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 stories, stories, stories. At the top of each show, we will give you the stories that you need to know for the day. And our top story is an important one, a serious one, and it happened all last Friday. We go to the German town of Frankfurt, known for their Frankfurters, probably. Were Frankfurters invented there? That's what I want to know. But no matter. At Frankfurt Airport, United Flight 59 took off like it might any normal Friday. Due for San Francisco, something happened a little bit into the trip. The plane did a U-turn and headed back for Germany. The reason? A broken toilet sent the entire contents of its waste tank flowing up and down the passenger aisle. Sounds delicious? Seriously, does it sound delicious? If that sounds delicious to you, you are messed up. According to a German media outlet, it's just one of the toilets that overflowed, but well, that was enough. To the crew's credit, they did try to figure out if they could fix the problem before the plane, well, emergency landed. But alas, it didn't work out, so they circled over the North Sea and headed back to Frankfurt. Passengers were given hotel rooms for the night and rebooked on other flights the following day. That, according to a spokesperson for United Airlines, who just said they were having a maintenance issue with one of their lavatories. They also said safety's their highest priority. But with poop flowing through the aisles, well, I guess that's... It's not unsanitary. And being unsanitary is unsafe. I was once on a plane where a toilet overflowed. Now, it wasn't overflowing with poop, it was just the water, but the water was slowly soaking the carpet from the rear of the plane to the front. And luckily, I was toward the front of the plane, but everyone had their feet up and bags up in the back. It was quite a riot. Honestly, the flight was only delayed 3 hours after it landed and we got on another plane. And it was so funny, I wasn't even that mad. I wonder if these passengers are mad. No word on whether they got poop all over their stuff. Here's an interesting story. You think I'm the one talking to you? Well, I probably am. But a new tool from OpenAI, that's the company behind ChatGPT, that was designed to clone people's voices. It's so good and requires such a small amount of time to come up with an accurate voice, just 15 seconds. OpenAI is saying that this product is just too risky for general release. They're citing wanting to minimize the threat of damaging misinformation in a global year of elections. The product's called Voice Engine, and it was built earnestly. It was meant to just be a text-to-speech feature. You know, a way to have an app read things on the screen to you. Seems innocuous, right? But I think the real question is, synthetic voices, voices that clone famous people, your friends, your family, voices that could be used to, I don't know, authenticate you to a bank, the technology behind it is here. But have we as a society adapted to this kind of tech? That I don't know, and that kind of scares me. But also, if I was feeling really lazy, I could just do this whole show using AI. I could have AI come up with the script and then have AI perform it to you. And while that sounds hilarious, as I shout into my microphone, I realize, how many more years can you have a gig like this? How many more years will we be listening to live radio and podcasts made by actual people? Again, that I don't know. But I hope it's at least a little while. But products like this aren't all bad. They can be used for things like entertainment, video games. Honestly, AI companionship. You want an AI girlfriend because this is how an AI girlfriend is going to speak to you. And while this may seem all doom and gloom, there actually is some way to prevent this kind of thing from stealing your identity or fooling you too much. Digital watermarks. That's right, little secret ways that AI audio clips can be marked so that anyone consuming them can see, hey, this was generated by AI. I think what you'll hear from a lot of people is all the scary stuff that AI is going to do to the future of society. But what people often omit is that AI can be used to fight those scary things. For example, a deep fake of a politician doing something wonky that could sway an election. Well, AI could be used to detect whether that was in fact a deep fake or not. It's going to sort of be like an arms race between good AI and bad AI. But it's just that, an arms race, which kind of has scary implications. Anyway, this one's kind of interesting to me, but it looks like this product, OpenAI's voice cloning tech, may not be in people's hands anytime soon. All right, up next, our first interview on April 8th. There will be a total eclipse of the heart. Sorry, a total eclipse of the fart. Third time's a charm, a total solar eclipse, and it's passing right through North America. And you may be thinking to yourself, like one former president of the United States, can I look at this thing with my naked eye? Well, if me giving you the answer to this question early is a spoiler, you either don't know better, but if you do know better, you're an idiot. So to go over that and more in science news is expert Dan Riskin. We'll have him in just a moment. We have here bat biologist, science educator, Dan Riskin to talk all things eclipses, probably.
Hi, David Cooper.
Hi, Dan Riskin, who's not a San Franciscan, who with whipped cream will do some whisking.
Oh, nice.
And your car engine is a piston. And yes, I consulted a rhyming dictionary because Riskin's a tough one.
Yeah, well, it's easier than my friend Tobin growing up. The only word that rhymes with Tobin is hemoglobin. So there were a lot of blood-related rhymes when we were hanging out. But Cooper is good.
Yeah.
Mr. Hooper, you're the...
Pooper, yeah, that's...
In my Sesame Street, you're the Mr. Hooper.
When I was a kid, my dad called me... And keep in mind, his name's Richard. He called me Little Davy Pooper. And it took me till about 13 to realize that not only is his last name Cooper, so he's Pooper, his first name's Richard, so he's Dick Pooper.
Dick Pooper, yeah.
But he was making fun of me for having that last
name. Yeah, well, he's got some scars. I mean, this is hurt people, as Kanye once said. That's what happens. It's just a legacy of abuse. So it stops here. None of this risking you f***ing. No, it stops here, my friend. I will not carry forward your torch of torture.
It sure does. Dan, I have some words for you. They are as follows. I'll stare directly at the sun, but never in the mirror. It must be exhausting, always rooting for the anti-hero. I don't like Taylor Swift, but that song is rumored to be about not liking Donald Trump because he stared directly at a solar eclipse like an idiot. Is that bad for you?
Does this mean I'm rooting for Donald Trump? Is that what happens if I agree to this? This premise?
Oh, that if it's not bad for you to stare at an eclipse,
like I'm rooting for the anti-hero, am I rooting for Donald Trump? Like, what? I don't get it. I've always liked Taylor Swift. I've always found the Taylor Swift's songs very fun. But if I suddenly find myself supporting the Trump campaign, I'm going to be pretty miffed at Taylor Swift.
Pretty miffed at Taylor Swift. Ah,
yeah, that's another rhyme.
Pretty good.
We are in fuego today. Yes, I see you transitioning to one of the science stories that I brought you for this week, which is based on a piece in the New York Times that scared the living bejumpus out of me. It's about what can happen if you look at the sun, not even for that long. So I, like, between you and me, I've always been like a little bit, you know, I always question everything. When they're like, never look at the sun. I'm like, really? Never look at the sun? What if I look a little? That's probably okay. But so anyway, this article in the New York Times sort of points to what happens if you do look at the sun. And there are, basically, it's a bunch of anecdotes together of people who have gotten eye injuries from looking at the sun.
Where do you find these idiots?
Well, the thing is, a lot of people look at the sun and don't get injured, and those never make so it's hard to know the percentages, but nonetheless, one that's like a pretty glaring story is not even eclipse related. It's some people, some women from a religious group in Ireland in 2009, that's what it is, 2009. They stared at the sun for as long as they could because they thought they would see the Virgin Mary or something
of
like that.
Of course, yeah.
But they just stared at it for as long as they could, and 5 years later, they all had vision damage, and one of them was looked at 11 years later, and she still had vision damage. So, like, staring at the sun for a prolonged period unquestionably can burn your retina, right? I mean, your eyeball is built like a magnifying glass to focus the rays of what you're looking at on one point on your eyeball so that your nerves can see it, right? So you're basically using a magnifying glass on the back of your eyeball when you look at the sun, right? So don't do that.
But I have such trouble looking at the sun. Like, when I'm outside at the beach and the sun's in the sky, I can't look at it even if I wanted to. There's just something.
That's your body protecting you. Yeah, your body saying, don't do this.
But
that's
how great. Are these Listen nuns to able to do it? Like, I don't think I could if I tried.
There are a lot of things nuns do that I don't think I'd be capable of.
True that.
Staring at the sun isn't the one that I put at the top of that list.
But you would look good in the outfit. I will give you this. You would look good in a nun outfit.
Thank you. Thank you. Maybe someday I'll try it on. We'll just see how it goes. We'll just kind of go from there. Although these weren't nuns. It just said it was a group of religious women in Ireland. I don't know what they're, it was pretty vague. It did say the Virgin Mary.
I heard religious women, Ireland, which kind of implies Catholic, especially if it's not Northern Ireland. And then, you know, Virgin Mary, I just assume nun. But that's
sure.
Maybe I shouldn't have done that.
It could have been just this other girl, Mary, who is a nun.
Yeah, she just never had sex, and you know,
they're like, where has she been? Let's look at the sun, and maybe we'll spot her. Let's see if we can find her if we stare directly at the burning orb in the sky. Okay, so the other one is a 2017 study. That's why I remember 2017 before. 2017 eclipse. A woman used her eclipse glasses for most of it, but right at the point where it was peaking where she was, which was a 70% eclipse, she says she looked for about 6 seconds. I don't know why she says six. I don't know why it's not five. It feels like if you were going to round a number, you would say five. So I don't know where six comes from, but she says 6 seconds. And then she was fine for the next few hours, but about three or four, this is what's scary, is with these kinds of eye damage, you don't feel it right away. So you don't notice right away that you've done the damage. And then 3 or 4 hours later, she's like, oh, my eyes feel weird, and I've got a bit of a blind spot, and my eyes are really watery, and I'm really sensitive to light. So she went to the eye doctor, and the eye doctor looked at her retinas with one of their retina-looking machines, and she had a burn mark that looked like Pac-Man. It's the shape of a 70% eclipse. It's disgusting and terrifying. And so it doesn't say how long that damage lasted for. They didn't follow that up in the study, but there is this like intense burn. And she also said that the blind spot was crescent shaped. So anyway, she wasn't looking at it for very long, whether it was 6 seconds or 8 seconds or 4 seconds or whatever. There's no like real, like 3 seconds is enough, but not if you do it like it. Don't look at the sun. Like, for the eclipse, get some eclipse glasses.
Aren't they so cheap too? Aren't they like $5?
Yeah, they're super cheap. I bought four for less than $20. I got a four pack. And they're not hard to get, and they're going to be for sale in a lot of different places. Just get a pair. And if you don't have the glasses, there are ways to observe an eclipse that are safe. What you do is you take a cardboard box. There's a thing you can do with a cereal box where you basically cut out the top of the cereal box and you look down into it. But next, you look down into it from the right side. And then on the left side, the sun is behind you and it's shining down into the box. But instead of just the sunlight going down into the box, you cover that other side with a little bit of tinfoil and you poke a little tiny hole in it. So just a tiny beam of light shines through to the bottom of the cereal box. And you're looking in and the light is coming past your head into the box. And if you do that, it's a pinhole camera and you can see the eclipse really well.
And that's why you're here. You're the world's premier cereal box scientist. Bat biologist, yeah. But cereal box science, you got that covered.
Well, I did this once. So I remember during a partial eclipse that it was visible from Toronto, I did this and I found it pretty onerous. Like, honestly, I was like, this cereal box, when I found that, like, if I just had a shadowy area where if I could make a shadow with a piece of cardboard and put a little tiny hole in that piece of cardboard, I could do the exact same thing without the cereal box. I could just have this sun projected on the sidewalk and then everybody could see it. So that's another way to do it, is just to have a piece of cardboard with a hole in it and hold it over the sidewalk. Or people have done dramatic things like holding a strainer and then it's got a whole bunch of holes and you get all these little moon, like these eclipse-shaped beams of light coming through, projected all over the sidewalk. It looks very pretty. You know, it's going to be a fun time. Like, the totality only lasts for like 3.5 minutes, but the eclipse itself lasts for hours. So there'll be lots of time to get creative and try to take cool pictures and all that stuff.
And that totality is when you see that wonderful corona, if you're looking at it through safe viewing materials.
Well, no, so during totality, you're allowed to look with your eyeballs. So as long as the face of the sun is covered entirely by the moon, which where I'm going to be is going to last for about 3 minutes and 26 seconds or something like that. So during totality, the glasses come off, you can look straight at it, you can see the corona around it, and the corona should be magnificent because we're in this solar maximum. So there's lots of solar activity, so we should see lots of flames coming off of it and stuff. In fact, NASA scientists are really excited about it because it's really hard to measure that stuff because the sun is so bright and the moon really blocks it nicely. So they're going to get better observations of the corona than they can normally get as well. So scientists are excited for the eclipse to actually get some data as well.
And I'm sure the Mexicans are happy too. That company is based in Mexico, Corona. That was a terrible joke. Yeah, see what I did there?
No, but you know what? The eclipse is in Mexico too. In fact, when you look at the path of the total eclipse across the globe, it starts in the Pacific, it ends in the Atlantic, and it goes right across North America, and the middle is in Mexico.
Wow. So you could have a corona while looking at a corona.
Yes. Singing My Sharona? I feel like we're bringing it back to the rhyme.
I know. We've come full circle, and that's why I'm the worst in the biz.
And an eclipse is circle-shaped. This whole thing is amazing.
Oh, pow. That's my brain exploding noise.
Oh, yeah, that was good.
I mean, did it sound like a brain exploding?
No, it sounded totally silent, weirdly.
I was watching this TV show. It's called Mrs. Davis. And there's a scene where a character just like does something and they're expecting something really bad to happen. And then nothing does happen that's bad. And 10 seconds later, her head explodes everywhere. It's violent. It's gory. Just like you, my friend, Dan. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Dan Riskin, welcome back to whatever the hell this show is.
Yeah, what a great break that was. I love those commercials, and I would buy all of those products.
I just stopped the taping. We sat there in silence and gave each other dirty looks and then started the taping again. That's what really but goes also, on.
It was implied that there would be some products that people listened to while they were listening to us.
So you're normally on the radio, on the TV, doing your rounds, talking to kids. You're normally a science educator, but recently you were hosting TV news. How was that?
Yeah, I was doing the morning show on CTV. I did. It's a show called Your Morning. It is it's like the thing you wake up to, and for most of Canada, from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. on CTV. And man, that's an early start, but it was a lot of fun. But I got to say, you and I did one of these last week, and I feel like I was asleep at the wheel for most of that. So I just wanted to apologize and offer as an excuse that I had hosted 3 hours of, or co-hosted 3 hours of television already, and I was a little bit of a zombie head at that point.
And the ones and twos of listeners of this show are going to be furious with you for being asleep at the wheel.
People are going to go back. They'll be like, I haven't listened to last week. Let's hear what Dan sounds like when he's really tired. This sounds really good.
Person is going to go back. Dan, yeah. Well, you're on TV. I saw a clip. You looked very handsome sitting on TV. You got your makeup, your hair, your cool glasses.
Oh, they put on the makeup. Let me tell you, they really put on the makeup. Like, when you get in the chair, like, makeup is a whole thing, right? So, in my current life where I appear on the news, I don't put on makeup. There have been, in the last, like, 4 years, maybe, like, three times that I have had a massive pimple on my neck or something, and I've had to, like, put a little bit of powder on that. But normally I just kind of hide it behind my collar. I just kind of put my shoulders up a little bit. Like, I don't put on makeup. But when you're on TV, it's not your choice, right? They're like, oh, you're good makeup, and you don't put on your own makeup, which is probably for the best. If I put on my own makeup, I'd look like I was on Rocky Horror Picture Show. But they have professional makeup artists, and they have their own styles. They have their own little thing that they're used to. And I will just say that the wonderful artists from Your Morning, they err on the side of more makeup. They like to put on more makeup. So if I looked good, it's because of them. They put on, I was wearing more makeup than normal.
And they use CGI to get rid of your goiter as well, which was very kind of them.
That is nice. That is nice.
But it was nice to see you in a blazer all snappy. I'm Dan Riskin on the news, as opposed to right now where you look like a disheveled schmuck wearing a hoodie.
Sure. Well, I mean, this is radio. I can dress however I want. Yeah, it's fun.
All right, let's jump into the story because it's kind of fascinating. One of the things about being a same-sex couple, unfortunately, if you try to have kids, usually it's just one of the members of the couple that is the one carrying the pregnancy or giving the sperm for the pregnancy. Very right. Hard if your gender was assigned the same way at birth as your partner to have a baby that shares genetic material with that person. Makes sense, right?
Yeah, it's tricky for two people who make sperm to make a baby because babies come from an egg and sperm. Like, with all...
Whoa,
like,
whoa, 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 whoa. I want to see the peer-reviewed, scholarly, triple-blind trials proving that statement, because I don't believe it.
Listen, gender is a choice. There's no question about that, and the world is a much more diverse place than the simplistic sentence I'm about to make. But when it comes to our understanding of how mammals reproduce, you have to have an ovum and a sperm, and you have to put them together, and those make a zygote. And
where does the stork come in with the zygote business?
Storks also make sperm, but you don't want that. If you are,
I don't want stork sperm. All right, okay.
On human eggs, you're unlikely to get very far. all of a sudden, the stork is a very dirty character in this city.
Yeah, like, raunchy
before
stork.
The stork was like this nice creature that carried a baby and put it down in your house. Now the stork is like somehow putting its sperm on. Like, it's just it's a mess. It's
a very as soon as stork. You see a stork, you're like covering your children's eyes.
Oh, no. Oh, no. And it's worse if it's a spoonbill stork.
Oh,
somehow
boy.
That's even like.
They are the perverts of the animal kingdom.
They really are. Because spoonbill, you think it's about their beak, but it's actually. Anyway, so here's the story. Is when you have an egg, so all the cells in your body have two copies of every chromosome because you have the copy you got from your dad and the copy you have from your mom. So all of your cells have 46 chromosomes in them. There's two of chromosome one, there's two of chromosome two, etc. But in a sperm, there's only one copy of each because you're making a new baby. So you give 23 chromosomes to the offspring, and then in the egg, there's 23 chromosomes, and those come together, and boom, you have 46, and then that grows into a baby that has 46, and it's got half from mom, half from dad. But an egg only works if it has half the chromosomes, and a sperm only works if it has half the chromosomes. So what they had to do to try to make a baby out of the DNA of two men is find a way to get a man's DNA into an ovum, into an egg. And the way they did this was to take an egg from a donor female, so it's a functional ovum, and then they removed the nucleus. So they took out the DNA that was in there, but it kept all the other stuff that's in the cytoplasm. So it's still a functional egg. And they did it at the part of the egg's development where it's actually splitting. And then at that moment, they inject the DNA from a skin cell from a male. And when they put that in during the splitting, it splits it just the way it needs to, so that now you end up with two daughter cells, each of which are only 23 instead of the 46 that got donated. It just cut the 46 in half, and now there's 23 in each. So now you have an egg that has DNA from a male, and it's only the half amount that you need to work for an egg. And so, bang, you're done. You've got it. And as long as it's the version that has the X chromosome and not the Y chromosome, it's going to be functional. And so now you've got that, and now you just do basically in vitro fertilization to mix that with a sperm, and that can come from the other dad. And then, boom, you've got a baby that has half the genetic material from one dad and half the genetic material from the other dad, and you'll need it to grow inside a surrogate female, And you need the original egg from a female, but she will not have DNA in the baby, except for mitochondrial DNA, but that's just a tiny detail that doesn't really matter.
Mitochondria doesn't matter. We heard it from Dan Riskin first.
Well, so in the cytoplasm, there are certain things that help the machinery of the thing work, and part of that is mitochondria, and the mitochondria have their own DNA, and that DNA gets passed down in the cytoplasm of the egg. And so in this scenario, it would still have the mitochondrial DNA of the donor female, but that it's a tiny, tiny fragment of DNA, and it doesn't really do anything special, and it's not really like inheritance and stuff like that in terms of the big picture of who your parents are.
So they did this in mice. Was the baby kind of wonky, or was it a healthy mouse baby?
Healthy mouse baby. And wow. So they're saying, like, come on, FDA, let's get approval and let's do this. Because the second half of this whole thing, where the in vitro fertilization, that's all like worked out and figured out. And as long as you're not in Alabama, you can do that anytime you want.
Oh, God.
But it's the first half that hasn't been worked out yet, right? And so that's where this is brand new stuff. And they were surprised. They even used the word surprised in the abstract of the paper, that it split as evenly as they did. Because what they thought would happen is they would take the DNA from dad and put it into that egg while it was splitting, and it would split, but it wouldn't split evenly. So it might have, you know, one of chromosome 1, one of chromosome 2, two of chromosome 3, and none of chromosome 4, something like that. Like the split would be 23 and 23, but it wouldn't be a split right down each chromosome, like the pairs get separated. But it did exactly what it was supposed to do, which was a nice surprise that the cellular machinery was smart enough to figure that out. So they're pretty excited about this. I think this could be a real breakthrough. Still, we don't know how to do the analogous thing for female parents, you know, two women who want to have babies. We don't yet know how to make sperm out of a skin cell, or the take the DNA from a donor cell and put it into sperm. But, you know, it could be coming down the road. It's an exciting thing to think about. And already it's progress in an exciting direction.
It's kind of exciting. This gives my mother a whole new arsenal of fuel to bother my brother, who is married to a man, to have children. So
yeah, they could.
This is exciting for my mother, because now she'll stop bugging me.
Mice. Until it gets approved for humans, they would have to have a baby mouse. Which is what's the book by E.B. White, the Little Richard? No, what's the mouse story by
Stuart
E.B.
Little?
White?
Stuart Little.
Stuart Little. Thank you. What did I say? Little Richard.
Richard Pryor.
little. Yeah. What? Yeah. What? Yeah.
Well, this is very exciting news. Kind of cool. The scientists had no reason to expect that when this thing split, that it would split evenly. They just were expecting a wonky cell, but...
Yeah, the process in the cell that does this splitting is called meiosis. And you normally, like... Anyway, it's a whole long story about how to get to the right stage. But it was at this stage where it was about to do... anaphase? Metaphase, where it was about to split them apart. So anyway, it's cool. It worked.
I was just asking, it did what I was supposed to do, and you were supposed to say yes, and then I was going to say, life finds a way, which is that classic quote from Jurassic Park by Jeff Goldblum.
I ruined that. Do you want to try again?
Yeah, sure. So, wait, it's split evenly, even though scientists weren't sure whether it would?
Yeah, it's a metaphase. So, but basically what happens is the cell is at this part of meiosis. Oh, wait, sorry. Yeah.
Life finds a way. That was some of the most terrible setup punch I've ever done. Dan, as ever, thank you for coming on whatever the heck this show is.
I like this show.
Do you?
I think the new format works. We're more of a rush. It's like more of a...
We're punchy.
It's fun. We got to be fast. Like no fooling around and thinking, well, I'll get to that eventually. You got to get to it now.
Well, that's how you and I started working together. I feel like if we had started working together and it was just sit down for an hour shooting the you-know-what, you wouldn't have signed up for it.
I might have.
Oh.
If I'd known you the way I know you now, I'm signing up for it every week with you, David Cooper.
If you don't know me by now. That's a good track.
I don't know what you just...
If you don't know me by now, you're never ever going to...
That was not if you don't know me by now. That was like a convulsing seal giving birth to a... That was bad.
Find out next week on This Is Going Well, I think. Convulsing seals giving birth to... Yeah, again. Dan, as ever, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for staying with us. We're going to try something a little bit different, a little bit new. One of the things this podcast has been missing is interactivity. And without getting too technical, I found a way to get strangers from the internets to give me a call and discuss a topic. And we're going to pick one of my favorite topics. And no, I'm not trolling you for April Fools. That topic is pet peeves. If you've ever heard me do a call-in show, I've done this topic once or twice or 4,000 times before, but we're doing it again to test this whole thing out. So we go to the phone line on the topic of pet peeves. You're on the show.
Yes, I can't stand people who smack their lips when they're eating.
I do it with gum. I'm a big gum chewer. I'm addicted to nicotine gum. It's better than smoking. Don't judge me, but I respect the pet peeve. What is it about? What bothers you about it?
I guess it's the sound. I'm not really sure offhand, but it just drives me nuts.
That bird. There's a bird.
Right.
I hear a bird. My God, what is that, your friend, or is that just in nature? What's going on with this bird?
Oh, that's the bird, my pet bird.
Your pet bird? What kind of pet bird do you have?
I'm not sure what it is.
Just you found
it's a virtual reality bird.
A VR pet bird.
Yeah, VR pet bird with AI.
That's upsetting. That sounds like someone who's never been laid before. But I respect that you called, and I respect that you have a pet peeve. You don't like lips. You don't like lips.
And you don't like birds.
I don't like birds. No, they're disgusting. And they cause disease? Have you seen a pigeon? Don't answer that. You answered it. That's okay. I wanted you to answer it. They're disgusting. They spread the plague. They're like flying rats. You know what? I don't like bats. Pick a lane. Are you a rodent or you a bird? You can't be both. Discuss.
All right.
You're a pro-bat in this argument.
Right.
I guess he hung up. This is going great. Let's go to the next one.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing so well. Our topic today, as you well know, is pet peeves. What are they? What do we know about them? Are they pets? I don't think so. What is your pet peeve?
I got this thing I've been doing since I was a little boy.
Oh, boy. It's not, pleasuring yourself in the bathroom, is it?
Well, that's part of it, too.
Okay. All that aside, what is your pet peeve?
Okay. Like I said, a lot of times I would go over to a friend's house and... You know, when you have to use the restroom, and sometimes, you know, the hamper's there.
The hamper?
The hamper. And
like the laundry hamper? You're going to bathroom in the laundry hamper? What's going on?
No. We're sitting on a toilet, I says, but clearly we're looking through the hamper, and maybe a pair of mommy's or your friend's mommy's underwears, you know, used, dirty, stinky, you know what I mean? Stuff like that.
And your pet peeve is you can't take those home with you for scientific evaluation?
No, I can't take them home for me, no, but I can sure as hell do what I need to do in the bathroom thinking about his mommy, maybe his sister. I'm going to get in trouble for this.
I'm getting in trouble. Well, I can hear it already. Keep going, though. I like it.
You can get in trouble and everything. Here, I'm a lot older now, and... I happened to be at a friend's house the other day, and...
We get it. You have friends. I get it. You're just showing off, but go on.
Well, if they knew what I was doing, I probably wouldn't have no friends.
Oh, I like you, caller. What's your name? I want to say Greg. Was I close? I'm really good with names.
No, my name is Ed, but that's
Ed.
Close.
So no. Greg and Ed is like the same name.
That's why I said, let's just leave it right there. Greg is close enough.
I like you, Ed Greg. Ed Gregerson. So what?
So is that a problem that... I have, or are there other guys out there? Because I can't be the only one.
I am Jewish, but a lot of my people have become psychiatrists. But personally, I'm not one, so I don't know if I can advise you on this.
Okay, well, like I said, I guess unless I get somebody to help me out, I guess I just continue doing on what I'm doing then.
Yeah, just don't get arrested, you know? And don't, my advice to you, don't let people find out. What people don't know can't hurt them. Thank you for calling Ed Gregerson.
Thank you, sir.
Ed Gregerson, love that guy. Next call on the topic of pet peeves. What are yours?
Hi, I'm Prosperous.
You're what?
My name is Prosperous. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Fine, thank you. My pet peeve. I have a cat that annoys me a lot.
A cat?
Yeah.
Yeah, my cat annoys me too. What does your cat do?
It gets over everything. On the table, on the chair... Over the TV, and it annoys me a lot.
Yeah, my cat has this thing where when it's done pooping, it you know, it's messy, and so when the cat sits on the couch, it makes poop stains. Does your cat do that?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, well, there you go.
And sometimes when I go, I want to sit, I sit on the pee, or on its pee, and that annoys me.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing your pet peeve, caller. I appreciate it.
Thank you, too.
Yeah. Are you having a nice day? Everything okay? You sound a little out of sorts. Everything okay?
Yeah, everything's okay.
Everything's okay. Everything's great. You got a cat that you hate, and everything's great. Thank you for calling. We appreciate it.
Thank you, too.
There goes Prosperous. These are getting weird, but let's try another. Caller, you're on the show. How you doing?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm,
I hear they tell you that you're terrible. What's going on with that?
I don't know. You're the one calling me terrible. What's wrong with me?
I don't know. Well, let's see. Let's talk and see if you're terrible or not. Let's get the idea that if you are, can't even do this job. Let's see.
No, I'm incompetent. I can't do any job.
Yeah, I know.
Let
just
alone
like
this.
Me. Just
great.
Tell me I'm not good at anything.
So you're terrible too. You're in good company.
Yes.
Our topic was pet peeves. What really annoys you? What does annoy you?
What annoys me the most is dirty people.
Dirty people.
Yeah.
People who don't bathe or people who are like
in
sneaky.
General, I just think that people are scared of water.
Scared? There's a real thing. It's called hydrophobia? Something like that?
No. Like, I understand that some people are, but I have seen people, like, they have running water. Water is free. You know, when you live in a rental property, landlord pay the water. And I ask them, why not? I have a problem. I'm Muslim. So I sit down and pee. I know it's funny.
I sit down and pee too, and I'm Jewish. So, I mean, just like that, we solved the conflict in the Middle East.
Yeah, and the problem is, you know, when you stand up and pee, like, it goes everywhere, and then you shake it all over the place. So everything in the bathroom is dirty. So anyway,
I think that might be a you problem. That just might be you and your pee stream. It's not a narrow stream. It's a wide stream.
No. I'm saying after people are done, I'm saying.
Oh, the shake.
Yeah.
I know the shake.
Yeah,
I know
so,
it well.
So I was like, you know, I pray. So it's hard for me to sit in a place where it's dirty. So anybody comes to my house, my friends, family members, I tell them, listen, there's one thing I need from you is can you please sit down and pee and wash your hands with soap and actually spend 20 seconds on it.
You know what my mother used to say? Cleanliness is godliness, okay? Cleanliness is godliness. Yeah. That's what she would say.
Yes, you are Jewish, so you understand. You know, like we pray, so our faith and religion begins with 50% is all cleanliness. After
yeah.
that, it starts.
Well, I don't believe in God. I'm just Jewish by
Jewish.
Birth. But I still believe in cleanliness. How about that?
Yeah, so that's my biggest issue. You know, like people just don't wash. They stink. I don't know.
Yeah.
They can't smell themselves. You know, I have, like, as a matter of fact, like in many occasions, there's a few people came to my house and their stunk so bad. And I am straightforward. I told them. And next time when I see them, they were still stinking. So I went to Walmart, bought some deodorant sticks. And when I went to the house, I gave it to them.
Yeah, you are. That is a very kind gift. That's not a gift that somebody wants to receive, though.
Oh,
that's
I know, I wanted to make a point that, listen, I told you twice, but you're still not listening. So there might be a problem with your deodorant. So I'm getting you a nice one, powder dry, so you can use that. So it will help you.
Great. I love it. All right. Deodorant presents. Well, thank you for calling. I appreciate it. Anything else you want to add?
Well, that's what it is. Like, they said that David is a terrible and it should be kicked off the radio.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Right,
well, I appreciate the feedback. All right. Peace in the Middle East, brother.
Right,
thanks for calling.
Care, brother, yeah.
Joke's on him. I was kicked off the radio. We got time for one more.
Hello. Miles here. My pet peeve is when people are walking behind me and they don't let me know when they're back there.
Yeah, so people should go behind you and just loudly shout, I'm back there?
No. It's when I'm like walking, like exercising and that kind of thing. It just makes me uneasy to have someone walking behind me when I don't know them or anything.
Well, quite frankly, I don't blame you. It makes me uneasy just hearing you say that. You know, it can be scary out there in the world with people. They're behind you, they're in front of you, they're beside you. Who knows what they want? They got faces and problems and bones and muscles and guts and organs. Disgusting. With their problems, awful people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there you have it. That is what bothers you, and I appreciate the feedback. Thank you for calling. There you have it, a little interactivity, a few phone calls, something this show was missing and now it's not. Later in the week, I will describe to you how to be on the show. Me and sometimes me with Tony Five will be standing by with a live phone line for you to call in to record a call on whatever the topic is of the day. Now, speaking of Tony Five, he is from London, England. He is our foreign correspondent. And if you're just listening to me for the first time, I ask you why, but also, I'm going to tell you with Tony about how we met. So coming up in just a few moments, mine and Tony Five's origin story. And And we are here with the lovable Tony Five from London, England, who, if you haven't heard me do this show, you will soon find out that he's on it, well, every day for better or worse. And one thing about Tony, he insists I play his stupid theme music every time he comes on the show. Now, him and I are going to tell you a little bit about how we met, tell you a little bit about ourselves, and tell you a little bit about our totally dysfunctional relationship. Without further ado, and now, live from London, England, it's foreign correspondent Tony Five. Tony, how are you, my friend?
David Cooper, the man, the legend, the myth, the circumcised wonder. How are you?
What a great way to start things out. I am fine. I have healed up from that procedure that happened at least a week or two ago, probably 37 years ago.
Do you only become Jewish when you have it cut off?
I unfortunately think that's like a part of it. I think that's, you know, like...
So what if you did it all of the other stuff, but didn't cut it off?
I think it depends on the sect of Judaism, right? I think more reform, more modern, more kind of liberal, more allowing of you to break the core, hardcore rules of the Old Testament. I think those groups wouldn't care too much. You know, especially if you converted, they wouldn't make you snip it off if you converted. But the hardcore groups, like the Orthodox groups, the conservative groups, not only do they sort of require it, if you convert in, they make you do it as an adult, which to me, I'm sorry for anyone who's super religious, is totally insane. That is completely, doing it when you're a kid is pretty nuts, but at least you don't remember. Doing it as an adult, totally insane.
All right, quick question. Did they check?
What does that even mean, did they check?
I mean, do you get a Polaroid of it and have to show people? Like, when you go into a synagogue, do they say, like, for example, for me, they say, yo, Tony, listen, can we check you know, like that? Do I have to bring out a Polaroid or a card or a doctor certificate? How do you know? I could go in there full meat.
Yeah, you'd have to, like, bring your tickets, you show the ticket guy, and then you go through security, they pat you down, and then the third set is the guy who checks. No, I've never been checked, you know?
Oh, okay.
Never
so
been
you
checked.
Might not even be Jewish. David, but I feel we are running before we are walking, David.
That is
Most people listening to us don't know who I am. They just hear the deep bass in my voice, the smell of chicken, and the faint aroma of watermelon, David. Let's go back to where it all began.
Let's go back to where it all began. Let's pretend nobody knows who you are. And by pretend, I mean nobody knows who you are. Tony, we met on the radio, did we not?
Well, you were on the radio, and I had taken a soul lonely trip of wonder to San Francisco. I stayed in what is colloquially known as the ghetto.
The Tenderloin.
And the Sirloin. And I loved it. I had gone out for a walk. I'd seen various people on the street selling stuff they'd literally just stolen from cars, and I engaged with them.
Yeah, it's always so sad, especially when they've got great stuff and they pull out and you're like, hey, you want to buy something? I'm like, dude, I can't in good conscience buy like a new MacBook computer for $400 that you just stole. Like, I'm not doing that.
That had pieces of automobile glass all over it where they'd smashed it and you're just picking it up and they don't know the specs.
Sorry,
David.
Say, you jittered out. Say, I missed all that. Something about the glass.
Okay. And you know, when you're picking it up and it's got like smashed automobile glass all over it where they'd literally just smashed and grabbed it. And also when I'm asking these guys, you know, technical questions about the SSD and about the memory, they generally are smoked out on crack and don't really have the technical knowledge I need, David.
Much like myself. All right, so you're in San Francisco, you're there for work, you're wandering the streets as a solo traveler, and what do you happen across?
So as I'm walking, I'll tell you exactly what happened. I wanted an ice cream, and I saw this couple with an ice cream, and I said, oh, where's the ice cream from? They obviously didn't understand my English, thought I was Australian, and pointed me in the rough direction of the Mission District, which is where we were. And as I walked, I saw this huge sign. It was like an epiphany. It was like when Muhammad saw the burning bush. It was that. It was a change of my world. It was amazing. I class it as one of the formative periods of my life. When I had sex, when I first went to a swingers party, when I first tasted Nutella, and obviously meeting you.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so I'm in the window of a coffee shop. I'm running a kind of a wacky radio show where you can see it from the street. You can see the window that we're doing the show in, and there's speakers blaring. You can hear the show, and there's a telephone number and a telephone outside people can pick up. So you stumble across that, and you picked up the phone, and all of a sudden you were on my show. We had never met.
No, so you were interviewing a chap, and there was a number, and you kept pointing at this number, and I thought, okay, well, you know, why not? So I called up this number, and then you put me on the show, and we started chatting, and I think you liked the fact that I was relatively insane, and I had a different voice to all the other people that you were speaking to, and we chatted, and I found it fascinating. I'd never done anything like that before. I'd never spoken to anybody semi-famous, and I still haven't, to be fair, and I kind of... thought to myself, well, no, this is fun. This is cool. And we got on, and you were nice to me. And I said, you know what? I might call again. And you said, yeah, okay.
I was like, please
fun.
Don't. I remember because the call wasn't that great. It wasn't until the next show when you called that you really threw me for a loop.
Yes, because I then realized I could bully you. So I thought, well,
it's not hard.
Okay. No, and I thought, well, I could bully this guy. So I called up, and then I called again, and then called again, and then called again, and I started listening to the show, which was because I had an Airbnb type thing, and I heard you had guests on, and I liked your voice. I thought you sounded pretty cool, and you were kind of quirky and wacky, and it's something that you don't really, well, you don't see it in England at all. You don't see people sitting by windows talking to random people. And
I don't
really
know that I've ever seen it since. I mean, I've walked by like the CNN building in New York, and you can look in at the newscasters, like, you know, but no, nothing. I've never seen anything like that. Like what I did back then.
Oh, I like the fact that you associated what you did to CNN. Right, so for those who are listening, this is a guy just sat in a shop window talking to people through basically cheap Radio Shack speakers. Don't ever think it was CNN and the guy standing there broadcasting to the nation with people in Times Square behind him. It wasn't that at all, people.
Touche. I'm just saying I've never walked by a live show before. That's all I'm saying. Other than that.
No, that's true. The CNN thing was a little bit of an ego kick, but it's okay. I get that. But so you did that, and then we started talking about things, and it was all kind of like over the surface. I used to travel a lot for work, right? And you asked me, oh, can you call me from wherever the next destination was? And I said, well, okay, well, whatever. And I used to listen to your show. And I thought, oh, you know, I was in, I think I was in China.
You're in Beijing or something? Beijing. And just running up to random Chinese people who couldn't speak English and just being like, talk to David. And they'd be like, get away from me in Chinese.
Correct. And I won't do the accent because it's probably get us banned. But it was...
No good. No dice.
Not no good. So basically, yeah, I would get random people trying to talk to you in foreign languages, and they thought I was insane. I thought they were insane. David, I don't know, maybe the listener figures went up, but it started like that. And then I had a weird obsession with you. I would laugh hysterically at whatever you said, and you were quite worried your girlfriend didn't want you to give me our address.
You wanted to mail something. I made you mail the address where the show was instead of my house, because my girlfriend's like, don't. You were kind of like, you know, on putting me on edge, like you'd say things that were vaguely threatening and harassing, and I was too vain to say stop calling my radio show, because here I was with a caller that I knew was funny, that my repeat guests were starting to know. You were like really great on my show. Honestly, you were but an oasis in the desert dystopia that was this terrible show, and even though you scared me a bit at the time, I couldn't say no, you know, because I couldn't help myself.
It was fantastic because your ego beat away the terror, the sheer terror that you experienced. It was fantastic. And I used to get very close to you giving you, you know, to getting your number, and you go, I can't, my girlfriend can't give it to me. I can't do it. And you can contact me on Twitter.
Well, fast forward, yada, yada, yada. I feel like we've described the relationship well. 7 years later, somehow we're working together. We're dear friends. You've had dinners with my family in England when I'm not there. But that's how
we
met.
My mum's given you tea, the real English treat. You know, you've come to my house and I had Thanksgiving with you recently.
You did. And yeah, your tiny Mauritius mother, whenever I come to England, which admittedly has been like twice, gives me pounds and pounds of chocolates and gifts and like knitwear. She's absolutely adorable.
Yeah, that's kind of a pricey of how we met, and I quite like it. Yeah, it's good. So keep listening, and hopefully we'll roller coaster back to terror again at some stage.
So stay with us. We're here with Tony Five, and that, in fact, is how we met and who he is. We'll be back with more whatever this show is in just a minute. Da 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 ba 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 da da. We are here with Tony Five, our British correspondent, to correspond about the new James Bond, who I think is English, although he might be Spanish. I'm not sure. Not the person, the character, James Bond, not the actor. I meant James Bond. James Bond would be Spanish, not the actor. I wasn't talking about the ethnicity of the actor. Not important. Tony, welcome to the show.
David, and hello to all the Canadian, American, and Caucasian listeners out there. How are you?
We are doing fine, my friend.
What's more British than Bond, David? What's more British than a white person going around killing other people in the name of the royalty, David?
Is that what James Bond does? In the name of the king, I shoot you in the eye?
Correct, absolutely. And it's been released today, of all things. There's a rumor, David.
Last week, because this is releasing next week.
Oh, okay.
And it's been released last week, released recently, or whatever you want to say. Yeah.
So there is a rumor going around that possibly the new Bond character, the actor playing it, will be a guy called Aaron Taylor-Johnson, who's a British actor.
Wait, it's a rumor? I thought they've announced it.
No, it's just a rumor. Apparently, sort of inside sources said that he's met Barbara Broccoli, who's the executive producer.
Wait. Her name's Barbara Broccoli?
I know, right? That's the best name
That's
ever.
An amazing name.
I would love to call my child like Barbara Broccoli. It's true.
Dude, how about this? The name's Barbara. Barbara Broccoli.
She could be an awesome villain and basically go around like literally throwing sort of steamed vegetables at people. What an amazing bad. Oh, that'd be a great baddie. Yeah.
The name's Broccoli.
I'm going to try and trademark that. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Also, Anthony Asparagus.
Anthony.
Just walking around. Absolutely.
The name's Broccoli. Barbara
the
Broccoli.
The name's Colin. Colin Carrot. Exactly. Yeah, it'd be amazing. Yeah, vegetable-based spies would be an amazing niche market, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you could have a little spy film of little vegetable cartoons starring Barbara Broccoli. Not important. Okay, whoever this wonderful woman is, who is my favorite person in the world, who I know nothing about, announced it, or what is she doing?
Well, no, there's been a rumor on the internet, as all rumors start at the moment, that this guy, Aaron Taylor-Johnson's had his audition, and he's gone green lit, and basically there's a contract there for him to sign or him to refuse. So the internet's gone wild. Is he the right one? There were people protesting, as they do at the moment. Should Bond be white and British? Could he be black and of another sort of nationality? Could he be a woman? Could he be trans? Who could be Bond? And
Any of those things offend you? Because they wouldn't bother me at all. I just don't care.
I'm a huge Bond fan. And the fact that this stuff, the stories are based on the writing. It's a fictional character, obviously.
Of Sir Arthur Conan, Arthur Fleming Doyle.
Charles Dickens is what you'll actually find. So he, you know, this guy created the Bond character because he was a spy. He was a spy in the British Security Services many years ago, and he had met this character and thought,
Ian Fleming was a spy.
Yeah, he was a British spy. Yeah, he knew intimately the details
of
spycraft.
So he based Bond on himself, kind of?
Kind of on himself and his adventures and people that he'd met along the way. So, like, for example, M, who's the main sort of, he's the head of MI6, the character is called M and signs his name off as M. But genuinely, even now, to this day and date, the head of MI6 signs his name off as C, which is it was the name of whoever was that was the first head of MI6. So even his name could be David Cooper. They'll sign off all forms with C. So it's kind of a tradition. But so I personally can't imagine anybody else doing it unless, one, they've got a British accent, and two, they're sort of like not middle-aged but sort of you know, fighting man aged male and white, and I'm not fighting aged male or white. So
as a black person would prefer a white James Bond?
Yeah.
I understand male, fine, whatever, but what do you care about the color of the skin?
I think we're going down the road where everything can be so recast that we're diluting everything. And for example, I know that there's been sort of films about the royal family and the royal, like the person who plays Queen Victoria is black. And I just think, well, is it a protest? Are you trying to make a point? I mean, the actress is good, but is it that good? But then how would it feel if it was the other way around? If a prominent black character was played by a white person? I mean, I don't know whether it would be accepted as much.
Well, when it's one way, I think it has to do with representation. I think black folks have been underrepresented in film for so long, it rubs people the wrong way. But I think in 200 years, if representation is about equal for a long time, let's say a full generation, then no one would care, I think. I think that's so, if you take out the cultural context, there is no issue. But with the cultural context, I get why people are annoyed.
But like you just said, the underrepresentation. So is the counter to that overrepresentation? And I think it isn't.
No, it's representation.
Like, yeah. So, for example, you know, black characters can play black historic characters. Absolutely fine. Asian, Chinese, Indian, you name it. It's fine. Jewish characters. There's been like a lot of hoo-ha in the background where there's been like movies about the Holocaust, movies about Jewish persecution, played by non-Jewish actors.
Yeah, I remember that movie, Munich. Munich. Inglourious Basterds was another one.
Yes, who were played by
like
sort of
Daniel
non-Jewish.
Craig, I think, or who was in Munich? I think it was Daniel Craig.
Daniel Craig, who is the former Bond. And there's another film that they played, Snow White. Something like that. One of the dwarves should have been Jewish and they didn't play him properly.
It didn't bother me anyway. When I see people who aren't Jews playing Jews, I don't care at all. The one, Tony Shalhoub, who I think is Lebanese.
Monk.
Yeah, but also Maisel. He's Lebanese, definitely not Jewish. And he played the, you know, nebbish Jewish father in Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. These things don't bother me as a Jew, but I get why people get annoyed. Fine, whatever.
So, you know, and I think, is that really something to get annoyed about? I find now people are getting annoyed by things that, personally, they don't matter to me, but they're getting annoyed for the sake of getting annoyed rather than, you know, having a real problem. Because when you sort of drill down into asking them what's so upsetting, what is the problem, they can't answer it.
If you're being honest, intellectual, what's the word?
Racist.
No.
Sexist.
No, like when you're being, like how many people that you're framing a certain type of person who gets triggered easily, who complains about, underrepresentation, therefore you need overrepresentation. Yes. You're talking about an archetype and you're propping up a straw man. And I'm like, how many of these quote unquote types have you actually sat down and talked with?
Well, quite a few. In my job, I do meet a lot of people, and I mean, I would say a fair representation of people who, you know, I've met people that are ultra uber liberal and are kind of like nothing really bothered. I've met ultra conservative people who don't even like me, but are kind of have to put up with me purely for the fact they don't like me because of the color of my skin, which, you know, and they're quite open about it. I'm quite direct with people, and, you know, some people said, like, I don't like you because you're black. And they've said it to my face, and I've kind of went, well, and I usually answer with humor, like, oh, I am, and I'm like, I never knew. And then they kind of get freaked out, and then we kind of get on. Like, for me, bridging the relationship with most people is humor. I think that's kind of a universal language to make somebody laugh or to make someone smile. And usually with that, their sort of prejudices and preconceptions are kind of broken down. It's like the oil and water trick. I see people, I hear people who are completely intolerant. And, you know, I read a lot and I listen to a lot of things, and I do find it strange.
I don't buy it. I don't buy it. I think
that sounded really good. I know fuck all people.
Look, I'm left-leaning and I prop up straw man of what I think conservatives are and I tear them down being like, people. But the truth is I've never really said to, you know, I just don't, people always, you're talking about someone who's going to get upset if Bond is white, and I'm just not sure that many people exist like that.
Well, see, you say that, but then on a radio show this morning when they announced this happened, you've got 15, 20 callers to the show who are just propping up, like,
yeah,
you said, that
stereotype.
Yeah, but
these are the nutcases who are willing to call. And they're watching media that's presenting it like it's a controversy when it's not, because they need to actually, you know, sell they need to sell to advertisers and to get viewers, and they're propping up these controversies that aren't. That's all I'm saying, and I furiously ran out of time while saying it, Tony.
David, don't insult our audience.
You can have the last word since we're out of time, and I clobbered you right there.
That's fine. Bond should be a fish.
All right, I could get behind that.
James Pond.
James Pond.
Love you.
Our last interview of the day answers the question that only idiots on the far right have asked. Do people who identify as feminists have better sex? And for those who don't identify that way, I do ask you the question, is it the equal pay that offends you? We've got a professor from McMaster University who's actually done the research. Her name is Tina Fetner, and we'll be back with her in just a moment. Do feminists have more sex? Well, the author of a recent article has something to say about that. She's a professor at McMaster University. She's got a book called Sex in Canada, The Who, Why, When, and How of Getting Down Up North. Sounds rather racy. Welcome to the show, Tina.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start here with a cliche that we heard by U.S. Senator Ted Cruz, who's everyone's favorite senator, talking about how, well, liberal women, I guess the implication is feminist women, are unsatisfied with sex. What did you think when you heard that comment?
Yeah, this is a pretty old stereotype that he is dragging up from way back in the 1970s. The second wave feminists had to deal with this. Feminists have to deal with this now. And I think the way that he put it was that liberal men are too wimpy, and so they're not satisfying they're women sexually, and that this is a problem. And I, I have research on this topic, and so I thought that I would share that and correct the record.
So what does feminism even mean to these people? Because to me, it's just someone who advocates for the equality of the sexes. I don't know why someone from that very basic position would have bad sex, but I know the word is charged.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's really interesting in the research that I have, which is based, I should say, on a survey data of self-reported sexual behavior of a representative sample of all Canadian adults. You know, I asked people if they considered themselves a feminist or not, and people got to, you know, just decide for themselves if that label fit them. And one of the things that was interesting is that I did find differences between the types of sex that feminist women were having relative to non-feminist women, but not in the direction that Ted Cruz would suggest.
Okay, so share some of these insights. What are you finding with people who self-report with that label and people who self-report without that label?
Well, the first thing that I wanted to test was this stereotype of the idea that feminists just, quote unquote, needed to get laid, that they were somehow having less sex than other women. And this was not the case at all. The frequency of sexual activity with partners that feminist women had relative to non-feminist women, there were not significant differences. But the type of activities that they were doing during their sexual encounters was a little bit different.
So what types of activities were they doing? Now I'm so curious.
All right. Well, I'd be happy to tell you. So and I grouped them into different types. So one of the most interesting and surprising findings was that feminists were more likely to say in their most recent sexual encounter that they kissed their partner, that they cuddled their partner, and that they had intimate massage with their partner. And so the sex that feminist women were having were kind of a little bit more lovey-dovey and sweet relative to the non-feminist group. That was surprising.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know what the correlation is there. I can't think of it, but that is an interesting finding.
Well, and the other thing I think that was very interesting to me was related to clitoral stimulation. And so the one measure that we had to see whether feminist women were receiving clitoral stimulation was if they received oral sex from their partner. And so we did find, in fact, that feminist women were significantly more likely to receive clitoral stimulation through oral sex from their partner than the non-feminist group. And so this is kind of the closest thing that is tied to a kind of sensibility of gender equality. If you think of orgasm equality, one of the things that we know from other research is that there's a gender gap in orgasm and heterosexual sex. And so women have fewer orgasms than men, mostly down to the lack of clitoral stimulation. And so it's very interesting to see that simply taking on a feminist identity puts you in a group that is significantly more likely to receive oral sex from your partner.
So you've got the data, you've done the research, you found that people who identify with that label and have the feminist identity receive more oral sex. Do you have any idea why? Did any of your research go into that kind of area?
Yeah, well, I do speculate why. And so I think that, you know, one thing is education, right? Feminist activism has focused on women's sex education, women's sexual pleasure, you know, has really created a space to have some social permission to talk about sex and sexual pleasure, orgasms, orgasm inequality. And so participating in those conversations, if you're a feminist, you're more likely to than if you're not. So education is one of the things. Another thing I speculate about is, you know, maybe feminist women are more likely to have a feminist partner. And I know from, you know, a different piece of research in the same project that feminist men are more likely to give oral sex to their women partners than non-feminist men. And so this is something that also could be a factor. But the causal mechanisms, we have to speculate a little bit, but I think that there's a lot of reason to understand feminist women have, you know, perhaps a greater capacity to feel empowered, to ask for what they want, to have a greater tool set to, you know, start conversations with a sexual partner. And all those things would lead to better sex relative to non-feminist women, the opposite of what Senator Cruz was telling us.
Yeah, seems like feminist women are getting to do all the fun stuff. Let's go back to that old trope. Let's go to the trope that the U.S. senator perpetuated. I know the answer to this question, but from your perspective, is that a harmful stereotype?
Yeah, I think it is a very harmful stereotype because really it is, you know, trying to denigrate the masculinity of liberal men. It's trying to, you know, diminish their humanity. It's trying to diminish the humanity of feminist and liberal women. And I think that anything that does that is, you know, is harmful. You know, I certainly don't try to diminish the humanity of conservatives or non-feminist women. I think that the sex that they're having is just as important as the sex of feminist women. And I think that it's really important to have this kind of information that's based in social science so that we can see the paths toward all of us having more expansive, enriching, and pleasurable sexual encounters.
Completely agree. Now, given all your research, do you think there's a way that people who aren't having the sex that they want, regardless of feminist identity or not, to start having better sex? Any recommendations there?
Yeah, I think it's all about communication, feeling empowered, starting those conversations with your partner and saying and learning really about yourself, what is pleasurable for you, being able to communicate that to a partner. And I think that, you know, finding a way to bring yourself, to give yourself that permission, empowering yourself, because I think we all, you know, deserve sexual pleasure. We all deserve to avoid problematic sexual encounters. And I think we all deserve to have pleasurable sexual encounters. And so whatever path we take to get there, I think is a positive change.
I agree. We all deserve that, except for maybe me. You are the author of Sex in Canada, The Who, Why, When, and How of Getting Down Up North. I imagine this is your primary area of research. How do you get interested in a field like this?
Yeah, well, I've been teaching in this area for a really long time, for over 20 years. And one of the things that I always do is to try to share data and facts with the students. And for most of my career, I've had to do that by using American data. And so being a professor here in Canada, I thought it's kind of time we know about what Canadians are doing. And so that led me into the research agenda that I have now. And it's really fun and enjoyable.
Are there subtle differences between the sex lives of Canadians and Americans?
It's pretty interesting. It turns out that, there are, and, it maps onto the differences within among Canadians. One of the markers of Canadian culture is that we have a French speaking population and an English speaking population, and the French speaking population has sex more often with more partners and has a greater variety of sexual activities when they have partnered sexual encounters. And because, the U.S. doesn't have that French-speaking population to the same extent that Canada does, I suspect that means that our averages are pulled in a different direction.
Just another way that French Canadians are making Anglo Canadians look bad. Tina, thank you so much for being here. This was a lot of fun and informative.
Thank you.
All right, that's the new show. That's the new format. That's season 2 in the bag. Look, it's meant to sound a little bit more like a radio show instead of a meandering podcast while still being a meandering podcast. So let me know in the comments below what you thought. What? There's no comments below. This is a podcast, not a YouTube video. Like it. Subscribe it. I actually do think you can leave a comment and review on your podcast app or just email me any feedback. My email address, as always, is david@jew.pizza. Not .com, not .net, not .org, not .ca, .pizza. David@jew.pizza. Thanks for tuning in, and here's the awesome theme music.